Here we are at Acts 28. 3 weeks ago, we looked at this incredibly dramatic shipwreck that led to Paul and about 287 of the crew that were on this ship being stranded on a deserted island. They've been washed up on shore after a traumatic shipwreck. They're clinging to bits and pieces of a broken and wrecked ship. They arrive cold and dripping wet in need of warmth. And that's where we pick up in chapter 28. They're going to find themselves on a strange island that at first they don't know where they're at, but they soon discover it's the island of Malta. So if you're there with me at chapter 28, verse 1, once safely on shore, and there you breathe a sigh of relief if you've read the previous chapter, we found out that the island was called Malta. Malta is an island in the middle of nowhere, and if you remember 2 weeks back, the commander that was taking Paul as a prisoner up here to Rome, which is about up here, thought that they ought not winter in Fair Havens. They just wanted to winter in Phoenix to have a little bit more of a straight course to Rome. In trying to get to Phoenix, they encountered a horrendous storm, and for 2 weeks were at the mercy of the winds and the waves until finally the ship was torn to pieces and they land, not because they desired to, but by accident, on the island of Malta. And so there's where we are, about 60 miles south of Sicily, Italy. And it's at that island that they receive a very warm reception by the natives. Verse 2, "The islanders showed us unusual kindness. They built a fire and welcomed us all because it was raining and cold." Now, my version says the islanders. I think if you're using the NRSV, it says the natives. The Greek is, and you'll know what word this is in our English language once you hear it, the Greek is ha barbaros. The barbaros, and that's where we get our word barbarian. Because in the ancient Greco-Roman world, if you weren't Greek or Roman, you're a barbarian. Now, that word doesn't have the pejorative connotations of being a thug, you know, a lunkhead that it later comes with, but it has the connotations that you're not sophisticated. You're not Greek or Roman. You don't speak the Greek or Roman language. You're just a foreigner. And here, because these are unsophisticated natives, we don't really expect much out of them. Which is why it's wonderful to see that they show this unusual kindness. They have people who've just been shipwrecked and they immediately build a bonfire on the beach in order to make sure that these men have warmth, that they're able to be in some way recuperated from this devastating tragedy they've experienced. And it's in the midst of this wonderful show of unusual kindness, of the kindness of strangers, that an accident happens. But the natives, being unsophisticated natives, don't see it as an accident. They're going to see it as providence. They're going to see it as destiny. That karma, justice, has reared its head, and one of the people who survived the shipwreck should have died with the ship. Verse 3, here's the accident. Paul gathered a pile of brushwood, and as he put it on the fire, a viper, driven out by the heat, fastened itself on his hand. Now, before we read about their thinking this is karma or destiny, you just think as a reader, Paul, I mean, can't this guy catch a break? He's just been through a shipwreck. In fact, we've read enough of the book that we know he's been through riots and beatings and stonings, and now he's just been through weeks of storms at sea and survived a shipwreck only to perhaps be killed by a snake that's attached himself by accident to his wrist as the snake's escaping its home as Paul tosses the log onto the fire. This is a terrifying thing. This could kill a man in the ancient world, and Paul has just been bit. Well, here's what the islanders think. Verse 4, "When the islanders saw the snake hanging from his hand, they said to each other, 'This man must be a murderer, for though he escaped from the sea, justice has not allowed him to live.'" So this isn't an accident from the natives' perspective. This is the gods at work. This is destiny. This is karma. Their interpretation of this so-called accident is it's not an accident at all. This is actually justice being meted out to someone who didn't get what they deserved when their ship was wrecked. They shouldn't have survived and got to the beach. They should have went down because this person is a murderer. So in their mind, justice is finally caught up with Paul. They're going to wait for him to swell up, keel over, and die. I mean, that's what they're looking for. That's what their experience has taught them. The poisonous viper attaches, you die. And so they're waiting for that, and they're waiting for it because to them, Paul's a killer. And what's ironic is Paul is a killer. He is a murderer. They are right on that. Paul has murdered. We know that from his past story. But we also know this, that which is sovereign in this cosmos is not fate or karma or destiny or some kind of impersonal justice. That Paul's living under a different providence. And it's a providence that has made it so that Paul will reach Rome, that he might preach the gospel there. And so they got one half right. He is a murderer. They got another half wrong. He isn't getting his just deserts. He's an innocent man insofar as their accusation goes. So here's what happens. Verse 5. But Paul shook the snake off into the fire and suffered no ill effects, which surprises them. And when that happens, here's their conclusion. Verse 6. The people expected him to swell up and suddenly fall dead, but after waiting a long time and seeing nothing unusual happen to him, they changed their minds and said he was a god. What a pendulum shift. He's a murderer. He must deserve this. He survives it. Oh, he must be deity. I mean, their analysis of this situation is so off in so many ways, and yet to them, this seems to be the way you approach when bad things happen to people. Bad things must happen to bad people, and if bad things happen to people and nothing bad happens, then they must possess some kind of power that puts them in a category that we mere mortals do not possess. So at this point, they have this incredibly high elevated perspective of Paul, and you just wonder what Paul does with that, because he's on this island for 3 months. In our text, and we're going to go just a few more verses, in our stories, Paul doesn't say a word. And some people say he doesn't say a word because he's not going to preach the gospel here, but that's not the Paul we know from the book of Acts. I would suggest he doesn't say a word because we've already discerned wherever Paul goes, he preaches the gospel, and I'd assume somewhere in the midst of his 3 months there, he uses this elevated status to then say, let me tell you about who the real God of the cosmos is. Let me tell you about the real Lord. Well, this elevated status at least leads him to getting the interest of the highest person in office on the island of Malta. And so we move to verse 7. There was an estate nearby that belonged to Publius, the chief official of the island. He welcomed us to his home and for 3 days entertained us hospitably. Publius is a Roman name. Malta is a native island full of barbarians, non-Greeks and Romans. So many surmise that he is a Roman official that has chief authority over that island, over this group of natives to the island. And because he has wealth, he has an estate, he entertains them. But I love the idea that he entertains them hospitably, which is interesting. So far in Malta, the natives are hospitable. Now the Roman official is hospitable. And while this hospitality is around Paul and all these crew members, Paul notices something in this man's estate. Verse 8. His father was sick in bed. That would be Publius's father. Which, by the way, never name your child Publius. His father was sick in bed, suffering from fever and dysentery. Paul went in to see him and after prayer placed his hands on him and healed him. When this had happened, the rest of the sick on the island came and were cured. So Paul sees this situation. Think about it. Paul hasn't ministered publicly for years. He's been in prison. He's been chained. He has not been able to do that which he loves, and that's to serve people, to help people, to aid people, to preach the gospel. And so he sees the Father, and without anyone asking him, he lays his hand and prays, which is a way of demonstrating Paul's not deity. Deity doesn't pray to anything. Paul prays, though, because he's praying to a deity. He's praying to the Lord. And he asks God to heal this father. The healing takes place, and when that happened, Paul then proceeds to serve the remainder of the people on the island, anyone who's sick, and he comes to them, he lays hands, and he cures them. He does so much good work on this island over the 3 months that he's there. When they finally are ready to leave the island, and we'll read in verse 11, it's actually 3 months later, but when they finally leave, they are left with such a high elevated honor that in verse 10 we read, they honored us in many ways, and when we were ready to sail, they furnished us with the supplies we needed. So that these prisoners who've been washed up on the shore have gone from being hospitably welcomed, which is surprising as it is from the natives, to being honored and loved and cherished. So much so, when they're ready to leave, the people hand out gifts. Whether it's monetary gifts or whether it's just that they're showing that they honor and respect these people, they're doing this in a way that when Paul and his cohorts leave, they leave furnished with supplies. And then next week we'll round out this chapter, verse 11. After 3 months we put out to sea, we'll finally arrive in Rome in verse 16, and then we'll see just the last episode in the book of Acts. So we're going to conclude it next week before we move on to the book of Romans. But what I want to do now is, we've had two short stories of what happened on the island of Malta, and I want to offer a handful of reflections. Because these stories actually offer some very interesting thoughts about what's going on in the book of Acts. This is the concluding chapter of Acts. We all know it's an epilogue, because the climax of Acts was Acts 26. It's Paul's defense before Festus. In Acts 26, Paul finally allows the gospel to be addressed to the kings of the nations. And the king, King Festus, hears, and he has to kind of push Paul back and say, you know, you're trying to make me into a Christian, that's not going to happen. But Paul keeps persisting, and nothing comes of it, but Paul at least gets the witness out. That's the climax of the book of Acts. And then there's this epilogue of how he finally lands at Rome, and the gospel becomes positioned at the ends of the earth in Rome. And part of that epilogue is the storm we read about 3 weeks ago in Acts chapter 27. And then now this series of events in Acts 28. And what I'd like to suggest is, I think Luke may be doing something in his conclusion of his book, which is quite interesting. The sea and snake are two great symbols of chaos and disorder and unrest and evil. For the Jewish people particularly, they're delivered and saved to the Red Sea. In the beginning, God created, and you realize that chaos, the sea is just roaring and there's no land. For the Jewish people, the idea of the sea being a place of instability and unrest, a place of chaos, was a constant theme. So that there's the sea, and you don't want to be on the sea, particularly knowing that there's no stability. You want to be in a secure place. Most notably on a rock, if possible, someplace stable, someplace that doesn't leak, like things have been going on here. You want stability. And then you have the snake. And the snake throughout history, for the Jewish believers and the Jewish scriptures, and even in other cultures, is this classic symbol of at least mischief. Because there's something funny about a snake and how it moves, and how it's hard to discern how this thing, this wiry thing, moves about. And it's just a strange creature. And from the beginning in the book of Genesis, it's presented as a creature that is a tempting creature, a mischievous creature, this strange power that perhaps represents at times evil, but sometimes health. You know, the snake around the medicinal symbol, and when Moses holds up the snake and other things. So you have some strange stuff going on with the snake, but for the most part, sea and snake are classic symbols of chaos, trouble, and evil. And if you look at the sea and the snake like that, you begin to see that what we're reading in Acts 27 and 28 is Luke's resurrection. Because in Acts 26, Paul has defended himself just as Jesus defended himself before Pilate. Jesus was put to death. Paul has a mission to go to Rome. Paul's not put to death, but he's sent off to Rome. And on his way there, he encounters the worst forces that could possibly exist. challenge him. The sea and its raging turmoil and the waves and the chaos of the sea and the threat of the sea to his life and to others. And then he experiences personally the bite of the snake that should kill him. And both the sea and the snake do their worst to Paul. And yet he overcomes. The sea and the snake do everything possible to avert the mission, to stop the triumph. And yet Paul, through God's power, is elevated to a place where he's able to overcome and survive these great threats to all humankind. Just like Jesus does in his resurrection, death and sin and evil does its worst to Jesus, and he triumphs in the resurrection. So it may be that Luke is echoing that narrative of Jesus, that even though Paul is a missionary bound in chains, he's defended his faith, he's witnessed of the truth, and nothing can stop him if God wants him to get to Rome. Not the sea, not the snake, nothing. That you have the triumph that is the same triumph of the resurrection, that the powers of evil can do their worst, and yet God's way will be accomplished. So you have this grand triumph in Acts. You have something else that's interesting and particularly poignant for where we're at as a church. You have this reading of the signs. Think about our natives. They see Paul and they see the snake attach and they say, you know what, bad things happen to bad people. And that's conventional wisdom, isn't it? You know, most people maybe won't admit that they think that, but most kind of intuit that that's probably the way things work. If good things happen to you, you must be good. And if bad things happen to you, you must have deserved it in some way. From the book of Job on, that's been our standard default mode of thinking. If you're bad, well, bad things happen. And if bad things have happened, you've probably done something to deserve it. And if you're good, well, you must have done something good to deserve it. But we know this. We know this is true. That bad things happen to good people. We know that because of Paul. We know that because of Jesus. I mean, Jesus is the ultimate example that you can be perfect. You can do everything God's way and still be met with the brutal violence of a Roman cross. So that formula doesn't work. But to these natives, that's the formula. It's the conclusion. This man must be a murderer. No doubt he's a murderer. No doubt justice must happen. And then when nothing happens, they say the opposite. Well, he must be a god. And so what's interesting is the conventional wisdom of the natives is unable to assess the meaning of the tragedy. It's not retributive justice like they think. Paul isn't getting what he deserves, so they inaccurately assess that. And then they inaccurately assess the turn of his good fortune in saying, well, he must be a god. Well, that's not true either. Paul would be the most vehement to deny that and say, no, I'm not a god. So they don't assess either of these well. And at the end of the day, what we realize as readers, and perhaps what we need to realize as Christians, is some things are just accidents. Did you hear me? Don't try to read something into everything. Some things are just accidents. They're just things happen. They're not always indicators that bad things are happening or bad people are doing things. Sometimes just bad things happen. Sometimes you pick up a log and it happens to have a snake and you thought you were trying to help the fire and the snake pops out and gets you. There's no message in that. There's nothing to be found. There's no way to interpret that to get anything meaningful because it's just an accident. And that's what we get in this, that the natives want to attach all kinds of wisdom to this, conventional or kind of weird kind of ideas, and then some of them just the normal ideas we have. But when in reality, this just is an accident that happened. Now, as always, God can take even these crazy accidents and make it so that through this accident, the people end up elevating their honor of Paul even. They say, wow, you know, this guy's can't be all bad. And so God can bring good out of even these accidents, but let's not always try to assume there's a meaning in every little isolated event. Otherwise, we'll make the same mistake the natives do here, and will swing from one extreme to another, and neither of them will really be accurate. So we have the signs that the natives experience, and then we have something that we need to highlight before we move on, and that is, if the gospel is about to break into the Gentile world en masse, if the shift from Jews being the prime recipients and the ones who respond to the gospel is shifting slowly to, as the gospel becomes rooted in Rome and becoming more Gentile phenomenon, this parting of the ways happens and we begin to see much more of a distinction between Judaism and Christianity. As that happens, it's important to note that the Gentiles in our story are welcoming. They show such unusual kindness that I think Luke might be hinting at the fact that this gospel, which is going out all the world to the Jew first and also to the Greek, which is for all and never wants to put anyone aside, is a gospel that comes in such a way that it is received best by those who hospitably welcome it. And you find these Gentiles just doing amazing things when they build the bonfire, just to try to get rid of some of the cold for these men, when they welcome them. When Publius just says, hey, I've got an estate here. You guys can stay for 3 days. Just rest, take it easy. You realize that these, quote-unquote, pagans are acting far more hospitably toward Paul than his fellow countrymen have for the last 8 to 10 chapters. I mean, they are so welcoming. It just puts the chief priest and others that have opposed Paul to shame. And I think that's important. Paul makes a great impact on them. We never read that he preaches the gospel, but he certainly does actions that speak of a power that is available, that is welcoming to even these natives, that is willing to heal even this father who can do nothing other than be sick, and willing to heal the entire island if they're available to receive it, which leads to my last and very short reflection. One of the most interesting things about Paul's life is he's saved to serve, and he's done it from the beginning, and he'll do it till the end. God preserves Paul's life in the book of Acts, not so that Paul can live this deeply meaningful, comfortable, wonderful, exciting, joyous life. All those things are wonderful. But God preserves Paul because Paul has a mission. Paul's been told, you're going to Rome, and you're going to preach before kings, and you're going to bring the gospel to the ends of the earth. And since you're my man to do that, the seas can't stop you. The snakes can't stop you. All the riots and resistance can't stop you. The prisons won't stop you. The chains won't bind you. You will get to Rome. And whether it's imprisoned and enchained or not, you will get there so that you can serve me. And what Paul does is he reflects that in how he treats these natives. He's there to serve. He is there to offer a helping hand, knowing that he's able to do that, and that the reason that the God that he serves has preserved his life through sea and through snake bite is so that he might minister the welcoming, healing, loving grace of Christ to anyone who will receive it. And that's what he's determined to do, even to the bitter end. And I find that to be perhaps the greatest secret of Paul's life. The reason why he could say, no matter what I experience, whether it's good or bad, whether it's loss of everything, or if I have all things, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me, because for him, the goal of life is to honor his Lord by serving and loving and gracing others. And in doing that, he shows us what it means to really live out the mission of being a witness to the gospel. So that's our island. We get to see the penultimate triumph of Acts, which, penultimate, do you know that word? It's one below ultimate. So the ultimate triumph is next week when we see Paul in chains preaching until the bitter end. That's the ultimate triumph. You cannot stop this man. The penultimate triumph is neither snake, nor sea, nor riots, nor natives, nothing can stop the love of God being expressed through him to others. Would you pray with me?